Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast. My name is Sadie.
I'm Stani. And I don't know, do we call this Tortured Poets Department Part 2?
Maybe. Or maybe it's just like the actual original Tortured Poet.
Tortured Poet.
Yeah. Tortured Poet, unfortunately.
Yeah, sadly, I think she earned that title. Definitely. Yeah, I was going to do someone else. And then I was like, I'm not over TTPD yet. And then you sent me this TikTok of this fam connecting Sylvia Plath and Taylor Swift's new album with some references. And it was like, wait a second. And then I realized we had talked about Sylvia Plath last month, but we hadn't really talked about her. We talked about The Bell Jar.
Yes.
So then I was like, sure, let's dive into this depressing story, How I Know How It Ends, and read about Sylvia Plath today. And
yeah,
I did.
Oh my gosh. I can't wait for you to share. I feel obviously we've been doing this podcast now for years, and there's so many women artists that we've touched on. But I feel like in our quest of the unknown women artists, we skip some of the actual big known artists.
And so
those people like Sylvia Plath, I'm like, I don't really know anything about, but I do also have a podcast about women in the arts, and I know that feels wrong. So I'm excited to finally like know about her.
Me too, actually, because yeah, it was very enlightening. I feel like there was a lot that I had heard before, and then there was a lot that I had no idea. And then I kept highlighting things because I was like, oh my gosh, that's a lyric. And oh my gosh, this ties into this. It was crazy. I feel like she definitely read about Sylvia Plath. I don't feel like you could an album called The Tortured Poets Department and not read about Sylvia Plath. So
I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. I wanted to bring up what the TikToker said first. So her name was like RubyM364 and talked about how she thought it was at least partially inspired by the American poet Sylvia Plath and her marriage to the British poet Ted Hughes. I feel like there's even more connections there. It was like, oh, she was with a British man for a very long time. So one thing that she brings up is like, when Plath died, she left behind a manuscript that was called Ariel, and it was later published as a book of poetry by Ted Hughes, and her final track on the album is the manuscript. She also left behind a second set of 19 poems, which kind of gives like that double album feeling. This part is something that I was like, wait a second, what's going on here? Because Ted Hughes cheated on Sylvia Plath with a woman named Asiya, I think is how you say your name. Asiya Weevil. And she actually committed suicide in the exact same way that Sylvia Plath did just a few years later.
Oh, that's really brutal.
Yeah, which is really weird. And there was like some accusations of abuse in his relationship. His widow that he had at the end of his life denied the accusations and said none of it was true. But they like in the TikTok, she brings up that maybe Cassandra was about that, where it's like a woman trying to warn her town about danger, but then she dies. So it's saying, I tried to tell you, like no one believed me. And then lastly, like the Fortnite music video has a lot of ties. I was trying to read about this and it got really confusing. Ted Hughes, bless his heart, has the vocabulary of a British man in that time period.
Okay.
I do not. And so some of the ways that he says things, I'm just like, whoa, what the heck?
What are we actually saying here?
Yeah. And I've read flowery stuff before, but I was just like, huh? So he has this poem called Last Letter, which apparently is like implying some things. And they don't know if it's entirely true, but it's like his version of the days leading up to Sylvia Plath's death. He implies that she called him from a phone booth several times before her death, like over and over again all night long, is what he says. And there's a phone booth scene in the music video. But he didn't answer because he was with his mistress. And can't find out if that was true or not. They feel like her downstairs neighbor would have heard based on some things. So there's some speculation on whether or not that's actually true. And maybe he felt really responsible for what happened and he didn't know how to express that other than saying, I should have answered the call. Maybe it was more poetic.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, that is what he said. And then also, Sylvia Plath was institutionalized many times in her life for her depressive episodes. And the video has Swift living in a psychiatric institution. And then also electroshock therapy was a major part of Sylvia Plath's treatment.
She wrote about that in The Bell Jar.
Yes, she had a lot of that. So there's some ties here. And also, like, in the music video, her and Post Malone are both tortured poets writing on their typewriters. And Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath were both
poets.
Tortured poets. Mm. Yeah. With their own problems. Yeah, we're a disaster. So that's who we're talking about today, is Sylvia Plath. And obviously, trigger warning, suicide, depression, abuse. There's not a ton. I'm just going to mention that it's supposedly some happened. I think that's all.
Before you dive into her life, did you see the one review that has gotten some attention? I don't remember what. It wasn't like a big publication, I don't think. But it was a pretty critical review of the Tortured Poets Department. And the opening line of it was, Sylvia Plath didn't stick her head in the oven, an oven for this.
Oh, I saw the title, but I didn't. Oh, my gosh.
I feel like that is a horrible thing to say.
That's but you know what? Me. Sylvia Plath would have loved the Tortured Poets Department.
I feel like that's fair. I just feel, I'm like, listen, you know why she did what she did? I don't know. There's like this like way of like almost creating it as like a quirky indie sad girl thing. And I'm like, no, like this was like genuine like mental health crisis, 100%. Like a terrible, horrible thing that happened here.
Speaking of this, I didn't know when I was going to bring it up, but now is the time. I have Sylvia Plath, the collected poems.
Oh,
and
okay,
I didn't get a chance to read the whole introduction, but it's by her ex-husband, Ted Hughes, which I thought was really interesting. But he wrote this at the beginning, and I was like, oh. He said, by the time of her death on the 11th of February 1963, Sylvia Plath had written a large bulk of poetry. To my knowledge, she never scrapped any of her poetic efforts. Wow. With one or two exceptions, she brought every piece she worked on to some final form of acceptable to her, rejecting at most the odd verse or a false head or a false tale. Her attitude to the verse was artisan-like. If she couldn't get a table out of the material, she was quite happy to get a chair or even a toy. The end product for her was not so much a successful poem as something that had temporarily exhausted her ingenuity. So this book contains not merely what verse she saved, but after 1956, all she wrote.
Wow.
And I thought that was like so fitting, especially talking about the Tortured Poets Department, how she didn't scrap anything.
Yeah.
And like, how Sylvia Plath is that to be like, you're getting all of it. Yeah. Maybe it's not fully fleshed out. Maybe it's not the most perfect thing ever, but I'm not getting rid of any of it.
Or I'm going to work on it until I find it to be worthy to share with the world. I think there's two ways to approach creativity. I think previously, I've like definitely advocated for, no, write the bad songs. Like, don't make everything perfect. And like, on one hand, yes, but also on the other hand, if you have an idea, take that idea to the end and make it as good as you can. I think sometimes I've gotten in the trap of, oh, it's okay to write bad songs. So if something's not good enough, oh, it's fine. It's just one of my bad songs. Mm-hmm. And so I just love that. I feel like that makes it so you're taking your art so seriously, which some people I think can find to be a trap. But I think that in a way it can show a reverence for your own art.
Yeah.
If you are seeing it all to the end and then therefore sharing it all. I think that's, I don't know, really cool.
I especially love the line where he compares it to her building a table versus a chair or a toy. Being like, she didn't treat every single thing like it was exactly the same. Mm-hmm. She just worked on it until she was like completely exhausted from everything that inspired her by it. And then she knew it was done. Like, regardless of what it looked like, she was like, I'm tapped out. This is it. And I was like, that's a cool way to approach.
No, I agree. I think that is really cool.
So she's a very fascinating woman. That's putting it lightly.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I got to know her a lot, even just by reading The Bell Jar, which I know people have pointed out the fact that it's like a little bit autobiographical.
Definitely
you really get
is.
A sense of who that woman is. And I'm excited to now finally learn her life a little bit more.
Okay. Sylvia Plath was born on October 27th, 1932 in Boston, Massachusetts. Her mother, Aurelia Schuber Plath, was a second-generation American of Austrian descent, and her father, Otto Plath, was from Germany. He was an entomologist, which they study insects, and then he also taught biology at Boston University, and he even wrote a book about bumblebees. which I thought was very cute.
Yeah.
And then her mother with her grandparents, they'd lived since 1920 in a section of Winthrop called Point Shirley, which Plath apparently mentions a lot in her poetry. And she actually had her first poem published when she was only 8 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, it was in the Boston Herald's children's section. And she continued that trend. Over the next few years, she published multiple poems in regional magazines and newspapers. And at age 11, began keeping a journal and also had a lot of promise as an artist. She won an award for her paintings from a Scholastic Art and Writing Awards in 1947. So had a lot of talents. And there's a quote that says, even in her youth, Plath was ambitiously driven to succeed. Her father passed away in 1940, which was only a week and a half after her 8th birthday. And it's actually really sad. He had his foot amputated because of untreated diabetes, but then there was like complications between it. And he thought that he had lung cancer because his friend had just passed away from it. And it was like really similar, but it was his diabetes instead, and he didn't seek treatment for it, which is weird to me because I'm like, if you think you have lung cancer, wouldn't you go to the doctor? See.
Yeah.
But maybe he thought he was going to die anyway. I don't know. So that was interesting. Oh, and she notably like lost her faith during this time period too. She was raised as a Unitarian, which I had to Google. I don't know. And it's basically like a branch off of Christianity that doesn't believe in a thing where God, the Holy Ghost, and Jesus are all the same person.
Oh, in the Trinity?
Yes, thank you. They don't believe in the Trinity. And then some other slight differences. From what I could tell, it's not that different other than a few things like that.
Okay.
They also believe that Jesus isn't comparable to God. He's lesser than, but still powerful. I don't know. It's little things like that. But anyway, so she never regained her faith after that. After her father died, her mother moved her children and her parents just a little bit further away in Wellesley, Massachusetts. And Plath actually commented on like the first 9 years of her life in a poem called Ocean 1212W, which is one of her final works. And a quote from that, she says, her first 9 years sealed themselves off like a ship in a bottle, beautiful, inaccessible, obsolete, a fine white flying myth.
Wow.
She writes beautifully. I'm sure you notice that in the bell jar. Like everything she says, I'm like, whoa, like it sounds like poetry.
Mm-hmm.
She went to Radford Senior High School and graduated in 1950. And then right before graduating, she actually had her first national publication in the Christian Science Monitor for poetry, I think. And then in 1950, she went to college. She went to Smith College, which was a private women's liberal arts college in Massachusetts. And she actually exceeded, like, all expectations. Like, she did so good in school. She edited the Smith Review. She had a coveted position as a guest editor on the Mademoiselle magazine, which was, like, everyone wanted that position. And so she spent a month in New York City. And sadly, the experience wasn't what she was hoping for. And so a lot of the events that took place during that summer are her inspiration for the novel, The Bell Jar. Mm. The editor was meeting the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, which is a writer that she loved. And according to one of her boyfriends, she said more than life itself. And like her editor didn't invite her. So really? It was like, yeah, really mean. She said she loitered around the White Horse Tavern and the Chelsea Hotel for 2 days. You'll notice
those are two things that you just. Yep, I get it. Okay, Taylor Swift knows her tortured poet's history. Yep.
A White Horse Tavern and the Chelsea Hotel. Interesting. Okay, for 2 days, hoping to meet Thomas, but he was already on his way home. So, yeah, sadly, a few weeks after that, she actually had her first, I don't want to say necessarily a suicide attempt, but she committed some self-harm and then said to see if she had enough courage to kill herself. So, yeah, it wasn't a good summer, obviously, for her. Also, during this time, she wasn't accepted into Harvard University's writing seminar with the author Frank O'Connor, and she had electroshock therapy for depression and then made her first medically documented suicide attempt by actually crawling under the front porch and taking some of her mother's pills. Which
this is very much the plot of Bell Jar.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah. She survived the first attempt and later wrote that she blissfully succumbed to the whirling blackness that I honestly believed was eternal oblivion. And then the next 6 months were in psychiatric care, where they did electric and insulin shock treatment, which I think you've talked about, that they tried to treat him with insulin, which is weird. And then electroshock, which we now know does absolutely nothing.
Yeah, neither of those things are effective ways of dealing with mental health. Let's be very clear.
So she spent 6 months getting no help at all.
Yeah. Maybe she got to rest. I don't know.
I guess. I don't know. From what we've learned about psychiatric facilities during that time period, I don't think it was very
restful. It wasn't a great environment, no.
Her stay at McLean Hospital and her Smith Scholarship were actually paid for by Olive Higgins Prouty, who had recovered from a mental breakdown and wanted to help. And he actually blamed the doctor who did the electroshock therapy right before her suicide attempt for her attempt. He was like, "You did it wrong. Otherwise, she wouldn't have. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, mental health, man. I'm glad we've made it farther.
Where we are. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, I will gladly take my antidepressant every day rather than being hooked up to a machine and given electroshock therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
She seemed to make a good recovery. She returned to college and then submitted her thesis, The Magic Mirror, a study of the double in two of Chvosky. How do you say his name?
Chvosky?
Yeah.
I'm not looking Chvosky's at it, so I'm not entirely novels. Sure. Cool. Yeah. Yes,
anyway,
I think that's
him. And in June, she graduated with an AB summa cum laude.
Nice.
That's pretty great for a mental breakdown right in the middle. And was also a Valid. Member of Phi Beta Kappa Academic Honor Society, and it's noted that she had an IQ of 160, and that meant nothing to me, so I looked it up. And I don't keep track of people's IQs.
That's
I was like,
so
cool.
Valid. That's so valid. I don't know my own IQ.
I don't think it's as common of a practice anymore to do it, but to note, Einstein was believed to be about 160, and so was Stephen Hawking.
Like,
she's really smart, you guys. Yeah, and the average person is apparently anywhere from 85 to 115, I think is pretty standard. Dude. Above average, yeah.
How do you test your IQ?
I think they have a full-on test. You have to go and have it administered or something. There's ones you can pay for online. But
I don't care enough to pay, but I am curious.
Me too. Yeah, I'm like, how smart am I?
Am I a genius deep down?
The weird part is I found like an article that was talking about people's IQs, and they had people clear back from like ancient Greece, and they were like, Aristotle's IQ is this. I'm like, he didn't take an IQ test.
How do
you
know?
Have no idea. But yeah, yeah, so I feel like it's a little fake. But during this time period, they were all taking it. So I feel like Einstein, Stephen Hawking, Sylvia Plath, you could probably
She was
compare.
On the same level. She was scoring the same as Albert Einstein, and we know he's smart.
Yes. Same with Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
No, they're smart.
They are smart guys.
Yep. So then she obtained a Fulbright scholarship and went to Newnham College, which was one of the two women-only colleges at the University of Cambridge in England, where she continued writing poetry and publishing her work in the student newspaper, and then spent her first year winter and spring holidays traveling around Europe. That sounds lovely. So obviously, while there, she met Ted Hughes in 1956. And she actually describes how she met him in like a 1961 BBC interview. So it says, "I'd read some of Ted's poems in this magazine and I was impressed and wanted to meet him. I went to this little celebration and that's actually where we met. Then we saw a great deal of each other. Ted came back to Cambridge and suddenly we found ourselves getting married a few months later. We kept writing poems to each other. Then it just grew out of that, a feeling that we were both writing so much and having such a fun time doing it, we decided that this should keep on."
Guess can't really argue with that.
I guess. I was like, a weird way to describe your love story. Be like, oh, yeah. Well, we just kept writing each other poems and we're like, oh, this is fun. Let's get married.
Let's get married.
Yeah.
If only it would have worked out.
Yeah. She described him as a singer, storyteller, lion, and world wanderer with a voice like the thunder of God.
Whoa.
Yeah. A lion. Interesting. Another Taylor Swift lyric. We're going to keep doing this.
I'm down. I'm fine. I'm fine with
yeah.
that.
Yeah. They got married. They spent their honeymoon in Paris and in Spain. Then they returned to Newham in October, and she started her second year. And actually, during this time, it was like the spiritual movement that we've talked a lot about. Mm-hmm. And so they both began experimenting with astrology and the supernatural and like using Ouija boards and stuff. It sounds spooky. It was like totally normal back then, yeah. As weird as that sounds. He talks about it a lot more in his stuff than she did. He talked a lot about them existing on a different plane and having psychic abilities and stuff like that. And I don't feel like she referenced that very much in her work.
Interesting.
She took a job as a receptionist in the psychiatric unit in the general hospital, which I also thought was interesting, very akin yeah. to the typewriter scene in the...
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, huh. And then after she finished college in England, they moved to the United States. And okay. then she taught at Smith College and then had a hard time teaching and writing at the same time. And so when they moved to Boston, then she started her receptionist job. And then in the evening, she would go to creative writing seminars that were given by a poet named Robert Lowell and also was attended by Anne Sexton and George Starbuck. And Lowell and Sexton particularly really encouraged her to write from her own experience. And so she did. She actually really openly discussed her depression and suicide attempts with them. And they started encouraging her to write from a more female perspective, which I found interesting. Because I guess if you're being taught by men.
Yeah, that's cool that her mentors were able to point that mm-hmm. out. That's really cool.
She also began to consider herself as a more serious, focused poet and a short story writer. And then during this time, she also met W.S. Merwin, who became a lifelong friend. Sadly, things didn't get that much better because she had to return to psychoanalytic treatment. From what I read, it's like a weird form of therapy. It's based on Freud, which...
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe anything that Freud taught, really, but they were like trying to do weird things with the subconscious and stuff to be like,
okay.
You're not depressed. Rewire your brain. I don't know.
Like the EMDR therapy before EMDR therapy. I don't know.
I don't know. It seemed weird. I think that Freud is a crook, but... So she was doing lots of that. And then her and Hughes traveled across Canada and the United States. They went and stayed for a short time at the Yaddo Artist Colony in Saratoga Springs, New York, which she said it was there that she learned to be true to her own weirdness, which I thought was cool. Mm-hmm. And she had a really hard time writing confessional writings, especially from like deeply personal and private material. So it was like a constant challenge for her. And this was something that, like, she was constantly trying to overcome.
Yeah.
Which is funny because her stuff is so personal. So they moved back to England in 1959 and lived in London, where they actually lived near Regent's Park. And she had a daughter named Frida in 1960 and then published her first collection of poetry, The Colossus, around the same time. I think within the same year. And then just a year after that, her second pregnancy actually ended in a miscarriage. And so she wrote quite a few poems about this as well. And then also wrote a letter to her therapist confessing that Hughes had beaten her 2 days before the miscarriage, which probably caused it. Right after this event, she finished her semi-autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar. And then immediately after that, the family moved to Court Green in the small town of North Taunton, and her son was born. A lot of things happened. She also, her and her husband started keeping bees in the backyard, and that seems random, but it actually ties in a lot to her poem. She referenced bees a lot, which I also thought was cool because her dad wrote
the book about bees. Yeah.
Yeah.
She definitely got it from him. That's cool.
Yeah. In August of 1961, so this was when right during her miscarriage bell jar situation, the couple rented their flat to a woman named Asiya Weevil and her husband David Weevil. Oh. And Hughes was immediately struck with beautiful Asiya, and apparently she was with him as well. In June of 1960, Plath had a car accident which she actually later confessed was one of her many suicide attempts. Oh. And this was because she had discovered that Hughes had been having an affair with a
senior. Oh, yeah.
So in September, just a couple of months later, they separated. Notably, they never officially got divorced. So that's just something to keep in mind. Like, he mm-hmm. was her husband through all of this. They just weren't living together anymore. So they separated in September. And then in October of 1962, she had this insane burst of creativity, just like crazy amounts. And she wrote most of her poems on which her reputation now rests, writing at least 26 of the poems of her posthumous collection, Ariel, during the final months of her life. I think they said it was like 6 months and she wrote wow. everything, which also felt a little familiar. And then she, in December of 1962, she returned alone to London with her children and rented out a 5-year lease at a flat that was just a few streets away from the first home that they had, and thought that it was like a good omen and things would be going well. However, the northern winter of 1962 to 1963 was the coldest in 100 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, which I'm like, no, thank you. That sounds mm-hmm. absolutely dreadful. And so the pipes froze, and the children, who were only 2 and 9 months, were like sick the whole time, and the house oh. didn't have a telephone. And so it was just like this horrible, miserable winter. So, of course, her depression returned.
Yeah.
And she completed the rest of her poetry collection. There's a ton of stuff. And like The Bell Jar was published also during this time period. You mentioned she used a pen name, Victoria Lucas, because she was a little worried about how it would affect people because it was so close to her own life. Apparently, like when it was first received, it had critical indifference. Like people didn't really think much of it. Obviously, a lot of the notoriety comes from what happened next. Before she actually passed away, she tried several times to take her own life, overdosing on sleeping pills, driving her car off the side of the road, lots of situations. In January of 1963, though, on this time when they were living in the flat and it was cold and horrible, she spoke to her general practitioner, who was like a close friend, and was talking about her current depressive episode and how she was experiencing it and had been going on for 6 or 7 months. And she was like talking about how she didn't really know how to feel about it because she was able to continue working, but like it had gotten worse. And so she was like, I'm depressed, but I'm working, but it's like constant agitation and suicidal thoughts and an inability to cope with daily life. And so she had a lot of problems with like insomnia. So she would take medication to induce sleep, but then she would wake up really early and she was like losing a lot of weight. But she also was like taking really good care of herself and didn't feel guilty or unworthy. So they didn't really know because they were like, you've got like really bad depression symptoms, but like also you're functioning. And so he tried to prescribe her an antidepressant, which was a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. I couldn't find out what that actually is comparable to. Mm-hmm. It was just like a basic antidepressant they used from the 1950s on. And this was just a few days before her suicide. So like she went, she sought help, she actually got something. But notably, it does take multiple weeks for antidepressants to actually work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So people have actually tried to claim that the pills, I think it was Hughes even, he was like, he said the antidepressants prescribed were a key factor in Plath's suicide. He said Plath had previously had an adverse reaction to some prescribed pills she had taken while they lived in the United States. And when they mm-hmm. moved back to England, the pills were sold under a different name. And so he didn't know the name of the pills, but then was like, if the doctor prescribed them to her and it was the same ones and she had the adverse effects, then that's probably what happened. And no, like,
yeah,
taking pills for 3 days, even if you have some adverse effects, aren't enough for that to happen. Just saying, 3 days, it's just yeah. not enough time. But it's really sad, too, because if it could have helped her, like, it didn't have time either. He actually tried really hard too. He knew she was at risk because she was taking care of 2 young children by herself. And so he visited her daily. Her general practitioner went and saw her daily. And then he actually tried really hard to have her admitted to a hospital. But obviously with her previous experience and everything and with her children, she didn't want to. And so he actually arranged for her to have a live-in nurse. I think that was going to start soon. I don't think they had started yet. Oh, yeah. The nurse was due to arrive at 9 in the morning of February 11th, 1963. And she was just going to help Plath with the care of her children. So it was just like a extra hands, yeah. like health here and there, like nothing super crazy, but just like added support during this time period. During that morning, she had actually, okay, so this is where it gets confusing.
Okay.
Because this is like when she committed suicide, but like they can't quite figure out exactly the time period. So the nurse got there and she couldn't get into the flat. So she ended up reaching out to like the workman of the apartment or whatever, and he opened it, and then they found Plath dead with her head in the oven that is famously known. But then she had sealed the rooms between her and her sleeping children with tape, towels, and cloths so that they stayed alive. And she was only 30 years old. And so this is where they're like, oh, her intentions. What was she intending to do? Because that morning she had asked her downstairs neighbor, art historian Trevor Thomas, what time he would be leaving, and then left a note, including the doctor's phone number, in this place that she left notes all the time that said, call Dr. Horder. And then it's argued that like she turned on the gas at a time when he would have been able to see the note and call the doctor before it like. But also the hard part of this is like the escaping gas had seeped downstairs. And so like he was unconscious. So he didn't wake up. He didn't die or anything, but like
it was enough to. Yeah.
Yeah. And knocked him unconscious. But then there's this biography called Giving Up the Last Days of Sylvia Plath. Her friend Jillian Becker wrote that according to the police officer who like went to see the scene, that her head was thrust like so far that there was no way that it was just an attempt and that she actually intended. I don't know. Can anyone really know?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, there's no way to really know. Obviously, she was just a very troubled person. Yeah. And the doctor also believed her intention was very clear. He stated that no one who saw the care with which the kitchen was prepared could have interpreted her action as anything but irrational compulsion. I don't know. It's horrifying. And yeah, obviously just really sad. She was only 30. That's really young. And one of her friends also wrote about her suicide and unanswered cry for help and talked in an interview in 2000 saying that he didn't recognize her depression and that he regretted his inability to offer emotional support, saying, I failed her on that level. I was 30 years old and stupid. What did I know about chronic clinical depression? She needed someone to take care of her, and that was not something I could do. So a lot of people just felt really horribly about what happened, which, you know, fair. Like, I don't think anyone wanted that solution.
Yeah, of course. And it wasn't their fault, but yeah.
No, but it's, I think everyone was going, oh, what could I have done?
Yeah, of course. That's unfortunately natural.
And I think one of the ones that was very tortured by it was Ted Hughes himself. He actually, because he was still married to her, he inherited like kind of everything and had like control of her estate. I guess inherited is the wrong thing, but like basically it all passed on to him. Makes sense. So he like arranged the funeral and got her headstone, and it actually said, in memory, Sylvia Plath Hughes, even amidst fierce flames, the golden lotus can be planted. Which, love the quote. A lot of people are really mad that he has Hughes on the headstone, especially when he wasn't there. So
yeah,
we'll get into more of that. There was also this quote about him talking about the end of their marriage that I thought was really interesting. He said, the particular conditions of our marriage, the marriage of two people so openly under the control of deep psychic abnormalities as both of us were, meant that we finally reduced each other to a state where our actions and normal states of our mind were like madness. My attempt to correct that marriage is madness from start to finish. The way she reacted to my actions also has the appearance of a kind of madness. Her insistence on a divorce, the one thing in the world she did not want, the proud hostility and hatred, the malevolent acts that she showed me, when all she wanted to say simply was that if I didn't go back to her, she could not live.
Oh.
Yeah. He wrote, they had been separated for 6 months. And I think during the time he was living with a sea weevil. And in a letter to an old friend, he actually wrote after her death and said, that's the end of my life. The rest is posthumous. Kind of saying, it's over for me too. Okay. What's weird? His wife went on to die, not his wife, Weevil, the one he cheated on Sylvia with, went on to die using a gas stove 6 years later.
Yeah.
So weird. I don't know why. There's so many rumors about it. And like a bunch of people are trying to say Aasiya wanted to be a poet too. No, she didn't. Oh. There's all this stuff that they're like, oh, was it a copycat situation? No, it was just this weird thing. He also cheated on Aasiya with a third woman. And so they think that's what prompted it. And him and Aasiya actually shared a child together too. Sadly, Aasiya didn't protect her child from the gas the same way that Sylvia was able to. And so their 4-year-old daughter also passed away during it at that time. So it was just this whole horrible situation. But people are very confused about the fact that he had two partners pass away exactly the same way. And I saw this quote, though, because there has been like a documentary or something about Aasiya talking about her life and how it's sad that a lot of the time she's turned into such a villain in this story. When it's Gash, she knew he was married. But
it takes there's another story there. Yeah.
But this quote said, the times were against Aasiya as against Sylvia. In those pre-feminist days, women saw their lives only in terms of being loved or not loved by a man. It was terrible to be abandoned and death was better than rejection.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so brutal.
So just really horrible. On another horrific note, and then we'll move on to more of her influence and everything. But her daughter, Frida Hughes, is like the only one who survived. She went on to be a writer and an artist. But in 2009, her son actually also committed suicide in his home in Fairbanks, Alaska. From a history of depression, which we know is genetic, like it is, it does carry on. But I don't really know the circumstances of that either, but just really sad. So talking about her poetry itself, like I mentioned, her first poem she wrote at 8 and then had written by the time she got to college over 50 short stories. Her work had been published multiple times. And so like she had quite a good legacy leading up to this. Her first collection of poetry was The Colossus that I talked about. She'd been shortlisted several times in the Yale Younger Poets Book Competition and had her work printed in Harper's Bazaar, The Spectator, and The Times Literary Supplement. The Colossus did good. It wasn't unknown, but was it internationally, nationally acclaimed? No. But in the academic circles, they were like, yeah, it's good. She even had a contract with the New Yorker. Oh. Things were going pretty well for her as far as career-wise. However, her 1965 collection, Ariel, that was published after her death, is basically the reason why we know her name today.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Like trying to figure out how to dive into this. So she was a presence on the poetry scene. It was published in America and had less glowing reviews, but in England, it was very positively reviewed. And this was The Colossus, I said, doing really well. Then The Bell Jar came out, and her mother actually wanted to block publication of The Bell Jar because she not want it.
The mother character is not a lovable one, I will say, in The Bell Jar. So
her mother really didn't want it to come out. And Plath was a little nervous about it, too. She described it as an autobiographical apprentice work, which I had to write in order to free myself from the past.
Ooh.
So I thought that was really cool. And
yeah,
she even talked about how she like threw events of her life and then added some color of fictionalizing it. And then just talked about how isolated a person feels when they're suffering a breakdown through the distorting lens of a bell jar. So she didn't want to hurt anyone. She was just trying to get rid of this part of her and get it out there. And so that was the main reason. Also, one of the love interests, I think, in the buddy in the bell jar, he's based on one of her boyfriends that she dated in Yale during her junior year. And he ended up contracting tuberculosis and was treated in the sanatorium. And then when she went and visited him, she broke her leg skiing. And that's what they talk about in the novel.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Crazy.
Lots of parallels there.
Yeah.
She also, The Bell Jar is inherently feminist, 100%. And she did that on purpose. She really wanted to talk about the fact that women's abilities to be writers and editors when society expected them to fill more of a secretarial role, especially her own role that she had as a secretary. Just talking about all of that and how much she wanted things to change.
Yeah.
And then after The Bell Jar was published, she was working on another work titled Double Exposure, which was never published. Okay, this is where it gets like annoying. And I'm like, Ted Hughes, you stupid man.
Okay. Like,
according to him, in 1979, he said she left behind a typescript of 130 pages.
Okay.
By 1995, he said, oh, it was like 60, 70 pages.
Whoa.
And then Olin Hughes, who I think is probably one of his sons, wrote in 2003 that the typescript was probably just 60 pages.
Okay.
So I'm, what was it?
Yeah. Numbers are like a finite thing.
Yeah. I'm like, finite, well, whatever. What do you mean? So anyway, so we don't have that one. Double exposure never ended up anywhere. So Ariel is the main thing that we have left from her. So because she passed away and then it was published, mm-hmm. hard because it's, is it so good because it's good? Or is it like so good because people were like, oh, this is the last thing she wrote?
Oh, this is a you know tortured what I mean? Poet. And there's like definitely a, I don't know, a fantasy. Not a fantasy about that, but it adds something to it. I don't think it should, but yeah. It unfortunately does.
I'm like, what is it called when people like look at car crashes and stuff?
Yeah.
There's like a mm-hmm. word for it where like you can't help but like
but look,
stare yeah. at things like that. Like the human aspect of that where we just can't help ourselves.
Totally.
And I think that's part of what happened here, but also because I think people walking in knew that they would be reading about the last moments of someone's life. Maybe it just made more sense.
Yeah, that's like you already knew the context going into it.
Because it's, oh, you talked about how she struggled so much with like confessional poetry and like writing from a personal. Ariel, 100% confessional poetry. They actually said it's held within the genre of confessional poetry is like the standard example. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Of like,
crazy.
This is how you write it. And so it's like, hard.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, she accomplished it. But would she have ever been able to publish that on her own? That's another question. If she actually would have allowed it, because she tried to edit down the bell jar so much, would her conscience have allowed her to do this? Really, it's one of those conundrums that I don't know. But she also, one thing they talk about is that she used details of her everyday life as raw material for her art. A casual visitor, an unexpected telephone call, a cut, a bruise, a kitchen bowl, a candlestick, everything was usable, charged with meaning, transformed. Her poems are full of references and images that seem impenetrable at this distance, but which could mostly be experienced, explained in footnotes by a scholar with full access to the details of her life. Yeah, so they're like, they couldn't really figure it out, but if you like dive in every aspect of every little part of her life, then you could figure out everything.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Okay. And they almost had a nightmarish quality to them, too, because she talks about like the domestic surreal, which I feel like we could compare to like yellow wallpaper situation, like how much that felt trapped and everything.
Yeah.
One thing that's annoying is that because of the confessional nature of her work, it drew a lot of criticism because people were like, why'd you have to do that?
Yeah.
And one thing that I loved, and once again, ties in, is in 2010, Theodore, I can't even say his last name, but some critic asserted that she had been the patron saint of self-dramatization and of self-pity.
Oh, goodness.
And obviously, they turned around and were like, no, it's autobiographical. You can interpret your life however you want to. It does not make you the patron saint of self-dramatization. Musician and self-pity.
That's so
drunk
brutal.
On her own tears, drunk so on to tears. Say. And they, it's notable that this is obviously ranked, Ariel is ranked the third best book in modern poetry among the 10 best modern poetry books. It is acclaimed. There's no denying it. It does not matter what a lot of these critics said about it. And they're like,
true.
Oh, she's so dramatic. And it's like, yeah, dude, she had
that's
depression.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. She had a lot of other collected poems. I think this is the one that I have. The collected poems that was published in 1981, edited and introduced by her ex. And it has like all of her poetry. After her death, she also got the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. And then also, in 2006, Anna Journey, who was a graduate student at the Virginia Commonwealth University, discovered a previously unpublished sonnet written by Plath called Inew, and so it was composed during her early years, and that got published in Lonely Journal Blackbird when they found it. Huh. Some other things, like a lot of her letters and journals have been published. there's like kind of some fishy things going on here with these two. Her mother went through and edited and selected the poems, the letters.
Okay.
And the collection Letters Home Correspondence 1950 to 1963 came out because of the strong public reaction to the publication of the Bell Jar. So Bell Jar came out after her death in America. There was like a strong reaction to it where people were like, wow, this mom sucks. Like, that's it. And then her mom turned around and was like, oh, let me release this. You can see our relationship and how like
the
Bell Jar was wrong and the unflattering portrait of her mother isn't true. And instead, it didn't work.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It said Janet Malcolm in The New Yorker said the publication of Letters Home had a different effect from the one Miss Plath intended, however. Instead of showing that Sylvia wasn't like that, and the letters caused the reader to consider for the first time the possibility that her sick relationship with her mother was the reason that she was like that. Hughes exercised final editorial approval. The publication of Letters Home also cast a new and unfavorable light on numerous others linked to him, including himself. Before the publication of Letters Home, the Plath legend was brief and contained, a stage drama, a few bleak, sparsely furnished rooms. The letters to her family contain unguarded personal commentary on her college years, writing, despair, friendships, marriage, and her children. Yeah. And that was the edited version.
And that's funny because that's like what the mom was like, it's fine for her to talk about them.
Yeah.
Not great.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So that's where the plot deepened and everyone went, oh, your mom and husband are really messed up.
Like, this is starting to make sense.
Yeah. So then during the last few years of his life, Hughes actually started working on like a fuller publication of her journals. I will say, like, all the critique I have about Hughes, he did dedicate the entire rest of his life to Sylvia's work.
Yeah.
And
I'll give credit where it's due. Whatever.
Was he profiting off of it?
Yeah. Okay.
But he did write very glowingly about her the whole time.
Yes.
So I don't know, but he started working on this whole other thing, like a fuller publication of her journals. In 1998, shortly before his death, he unsealed the two journals and passed the project on to his children, Frida and Nicholas, which were his two children by Plath, who then passed it on to another person who finished her editing. And in 2000, the unabridged journals of Sylvia Plath was published, which had more than half of new material. Which I'm like, how much did she leave? Apparently a freaking lot. They even called it like a genuine literary event. Like, it was this huge thing, like Sylvia Plath's journals like hit.
Wow.
Yeah. One thing that he gets the most criticism for, he destroyed her last journal.
Probably the most incriminating one to him.
Yeah. It contained entries from the winter of 1962 up until her death. And he wrote, actually, in the 1982 version, saying, I destroyed the last of her journals because I didn't want her children to have to read it.
Okay, if that's true, then honestly, I can see that.
And especially, but then it's also like,
I feel like there's already a moral grayness to publishing somebody's journals posthumously anyway, when there's no way that you can get any type of verbal consent.
That's so true.
Sure, it probably helps cement her as a literary figure and carry on a legacy, but I don't know. Like, again, some moral grayness going on in there. And maybe his intentions weren't fully good, but actually, I can see that, like, who knows what she was saying? I don't know. That's hard. Oh, that's hard. I don't even know at all what's... Oh, that's sad, though.
Yeah, there's a poem from Ariel. It's called Kindness. I'm just going to read part of it. It said, Hughes controversies, and here you come with a cup of tea, wreathed in steam. The blood jet is poetry. There is no stopping it. You hand me two children, two roses.
Whoa. Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. And that's one of the things that the person brought up, too, is the parallels, like the two albums.
So actually, it's all about Sylvia Plath.
Forget everyone else. It's all about
it's
Sylvia Plath.
It's not about Joe Alwyn or Maddie Healy at all. This is Sylvia Plath.
Okay. Just wrapping everything up. Like we talked about, they were legally married. So he got all of her written work. And he also lost another journal.
Okay.
And an unfinished novel. And he also instructed that a collection of her papers and journals should not be released until 2013. I don't know if they were.
That's what I was just wondering.
Were they? Didn't follow up. I'm not entirely sure. thing that is nice, so we did talk about he probably was financially compensating from it.
Yeah.
But royalties were placed in a trust account for her two children. I'm not sure exactly what entire percentage, but he took care of his kids with it too.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't think he was inherently evil. I just think that it was a very complicated relationship. People are very complicated. And there was a lot going on. Her headstone has actually repeatedly been vandalized because people are so mad about the fact that Hughes is on her stone. So they attempt to chisel it off over and over again. And when Hughes' mistress, Acia Weevil, died, it increased. It's like people were more mad at him. There's actually like some crazy conspiracy theories that like he murdered them both. That he like learned how to do it with Sylvia and then turned around and did it with Acia too.
Whoa.
I don't think that's true at all. But
tragedy
like,
creates all kinds of nonsense.
Yeah. So because of the defacement, he actually had the stone removed. But then people got really mad at him because then they were like, now her stone's gone. So that's dishonorable. Mm-hmm. And like all this stuff. And there's obviously a lot of rumors about domestic abuse on his part too. We don't know.
Yeah.
We have that one little mention of it from Plath and that.
I wouldn't be surprised, though, based off of what you're telling me. I feel like probably true.
Yeah. Some people got a little too radical, though. Some fangirls, I will say. Because there was like this poem published called Arraignment where they like openly accused Hughes of battery and murder of Plath. And then wrote a book, too, where they, like, had this insane thing where, like, a gang of Plath fans castrate him and then kill him and all this crap. And so he actually threatened to sue her. And so the book was withdrawn, but it remained in circulation among feminists. So, like, people still read it. These are, like, the craziest guys. Plath! Talk about radicalization. And then they also threatened to kill him in her name and pursue a conviction for murder.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Apparently there is a poem by Plath called The Jailer, which talks about the speaker condemning her husband's brutality. Fresh from the slammer, anyone?
Interesting.
Hughes obviously got eviscerated by the media. Talk about being mad at someone's ex.
Yeah.
Really bad. There was like a battle of letters in The Guardian and The Independent. In The Guardian in 1989, Hughes wrote this piece, The Place Where Sylvia Plath Should Rest in Peace. And then in the year soon after Plath's death, when scholars approached me, I tried to take their apparently serious concern for the truth of Sylvia Plath seriously. But I learned my lesson early. If I tried too hard to tell them exactly how something happened in the hope of correcting some fantasy, I was quite likely to be accused of trying to suppress free speech. In general, my refusal to have anything to do with the Plath Fantasia has been regarded as an attempt to suppress free speech. The Fantasia about Sylvia Plath is more needed than the facts. Where that leaves respect for the truth of her life and of mine, or for her memory, or for the literary tradition, I do not know. So that was interesting. At the very end of his life, he actually wrote his own collection of poetry. It was 88 poems about his relationship with Plath, and he had talked very little about his marriage with her and like the suicide, and so it was this other like literary sensation. It topped the bestseller charts, and it wasn't known at the time, but he actually had terminal cancer, and so he was going to die later that year. But it won the Forward Poetry Prize, the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry, and the Red Poetry Prize. And apparently it was just this long, was all of these letters for like her birthday, but then long after her death, like trying to figure out reasons why she committed suicide. Yeah. And that's where the stuff with this she called multiple times, like all of that comes from there, where they're like not entirely sure if she left him a suicide note in the journal and that's why he got rid of it, or kind of stuff like that. There's some weird things in there that don't really add up.
Yeah.
A few more things. Oh, I mentioned 6 months. It was actually 2 months. She wrote 40 poems of rage, despair, love, and vengeance on which her reputation mostly rests. I thought that was a cool quote. There are so many books about Plath.
Like,
probably one of the most written about people.
Yeah.
Which is insane. And especially about Ted Hughes, too. People have done full college dissertations on this. It's crazy how many things have been written about her. And with her publication of Ariel, she actually was the best known female American poet of the 20th century for a really long time. There's just like a lot there. Yeah. She's seen as like a feminist icon. A lot of people talk about like her mental health and like her mother and her father and her, who apparently just ignored her. And then her husband, who's believed to be abusive. And there was this quote by Alvarez that says, "The very source of Plath's creative energy was that it turned out her self-destructiveness. But it was precisely a source of living energy, of her imaginative, creative power. So though death itself may have been a side issue, it also was an unavoidable risk in writing her kind of poem. My own impression of the circumstances surrounding her eventual death is that she gambled, not much caring whether she won or lost, and she lost." And then another quote said, "Some of the feminist movement saw Plath as speaking for their experience as a symbol of blighted female genius. Ariel marked the beginning of a movement. Plath suddenly visible as a woman on paper, certain and audacious. When Sylvia Plath's Ariel was published in the United States in 1966, American women noticed, not only women who ordinarily read poems, but housewives and mothers whose ambitions had awakened. Here was a woman, superbly trained in her craft, whose final poems uncompromisingly charted female rage, ambivalence, and grief in a voice which many women identified." Oh, and yeah, there are over 104 books in print about Plath, and that was in 2000. So we've got 20 years since then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's so many more. That's crazy.
That continues. Gosh, I don't even know how to like tie this up. They made a documentary about her, and her daughter actually was really mad about the whole thing. She was only two when her mother died. And she's constantly phrased how much she hates that people turn her parents' lives into entertainment. Yeah. So she wrote a poem herself saying, "Now they want to make a film for anyone lacking the ability to imagine the body, head in oven, orphaning children. They think I should give them my mother's words to fill the mouth of their monster, their Sylvia suicide doll."
Yeah, I saw someone sharing that poem she had written in response to the fact that Music Review had started the thing of, no, like the family doesn't want this. This isn't, again, like this isn't your token, edgy, indie, cool thing to rip on. That's, I don't know. It is actually a tragedy. It's not just like a funny little pop culture thing. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I'm going to end with a quote that Hughes had about her talent, and then I want to read one of her poems, and then we'll be
Yay.
Done. Okay? Okay.
I'm great.
Okay, cool. I know I'm like, city of premise, almost done, but you're like, no, like,
I'm, yeah, like, I'm sad. I'm not going anywhere.
There was just so much information. I feel like that's why I'm like,
another thing. You know, yeah. All good.
Actually, I thought it was really beautiful. He was talking about her personality and talent. She said, "Her poetry escapes ordinary analysis in the way clairvoyance and mediumship do. Her psychic gifts at almost any time were strong enough to make her frequently wish to be rid of them. In her poetry, in other words, she had free and controlled access to depths formerly reserved to the primitive, ecstatic priests, shamans, and holy men. Severed as a whole, I think the unity of her opus is clear. Once the unity shows itself, the logic and inevitability of the language which controls and contains such configurations of collisions within itself becomes more obviously what it is. Direct and even plain speech," which he does not have. "This language, this unique and radiant substance is the product of an alchemy on the noblest scale. Her elements were extreme, a violent, almost demonic spirit in her opposed to tenderness and capacity to suffer and love things infinitely, which was just as great and far more in evidence. Her stormy, luminous senses assaulted a downright practical intelligence that probably could have dealt with anything. She saw her world in the flame of the ultimate substance and the ultimate depth. And this is the distinction of her language, that every word is Baraka, the flame and the rose folded together. Poets have often spoken about this ideal possibility, but where else outside these poems has it actually occurred? If we have the discrimination to answer this question, we can set her in her rightful company." Mm-hmm. She's just beyond, like.
Yeah, that's so nice, actually. Yeah.
And I think it's like very true. Yeah. I read like one of her poems because I was very fascinated by the title. It's from Ariel, and I'll just read. It's short. We'll just read. So it's called Lady Lazarus, which I really loved. And it says, "I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin, bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot, a paperweight. My face, a featureless fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy, do I terrify? The noise, the eye pits, the full set of teeth? The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon the flesh, the grave cave eight will be at home on me. And I, a smiling woman, I am only 30. And like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments the peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see. Them unwrap me hand and foot, the big striptease. Gentlemen, these are my hands, my knees. I may be skin and bone. Nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time, I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell, and they had to call and pick the worms off of me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art. Like everything else, I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I have a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's the theatrical comeback in a broad day. To the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout, a miracle that knocks me out. There is a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There is a charge for the hearing of my heart. It really goes. And there is a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of hair or my clothes. Air docator, so air enemy. I am your opus. I am your valuable, the pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir. Flesh, bone, there is nothing there. A cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Air God, air Lucifer, beware. Out of the ash, I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I loved that. And there was also, I feel like if you want to get more out of the Tortured Poets Department, read Sylvia Plath. 100,000%. And also, I just think there's so much to it. It's almost as if she knew how much the public would frenzy over her death before it even happened.
Yeah.
It's weird because I did read a thing that talked about how some of her poems make more sense as if she had written them after she had already passed away.
Oh, yeah.
Which isn't possible, right? But like, it just kind of sounds...
almost like preemptively written that way. It's like almost like she wrote it to be.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because she like references things that didn't happen until after.
Oh.
Yeah. Because like this, the peanut crunching crowd, and it's, she wasn't particularly famous, but this feels like fame. This feels like someone being watched and...
Yeah. Obsessed over.
So it's just really, really interesting. I'm like more fascinated by her than ever. I'm like, what the heck?
Same. I'm like, I need a collection of her works now. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, definitely. So very intriguing and very 100% the original Tortured Poet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
tragic. Wow. Thank you for finally getting around to telling her story for us. I do feel more inspired to go check out this tragically iconic. I was gonna say iconic, but that did feel weird. But this
an infamous story.
Infamous story of Sylvia Plath and the incredible writer and artist that she was.
I will say, if you need artistic inspiration, I do feel like her lines would be so easy to turn to one of them and be like, oh. And that would spark something. And I think that's the legacy that she left behind, is that they inferred that maybe she speared on the feminist movement of the 1960s. And I hope in some way that is true. Like, everyone was like, let's not have another housewife end that way. And yeah, she definitely made a huge impact on poetry and all of that.
Dang. Yep. Again, thank you. And whoever's listening, I hope you enjoyed learning more. And also, I mean... hopefully it wasn't blasphemous for whoever's listening for us to compare it to the Tortured Poets Department album. But listen, we're big Taylor Swift fans. We're going to find the intersection. And I thought that was a very interesting TikTok.
I agree.
So I'm glad that it inspired this episode.
Yeah, me too. I'm not saying they're like comparable in works or anything like that. I'm just saying I think it's possible for women of the present day to be inspired by women from the past. Ahem, why we are here.
Hence why this has been happening.
And I just feel like if you're going to write an album called The Tortured Poet Department, you probably read Sylvia Plath for months. And
here we are now.
Yeah, after a breakup, sitting down and writing an entire work of poetry, it's pretty relatable. So.
I feel like that's probably pretty accurate. Amazing. Yeah,
definitely.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us back for another episode. And we'll be back next week. Same time, same day, same place.
Yes, we will. We'll be back. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, follow so you don't miss another episode, because we're here pretty much every Monday. We missed a few here and there, but we're pretty consistent. So have a good Monday, have a good week, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.